it's quite hard to imagine what Fair Isle would be like without the Bird Observatory. It's a resilient community, you know. I'm sure, as they've proven over the last couple of years, they're capable of getting on. But yeah, I think it would be a very different place.
Hello and welcome back to Seagazing, a podcast about conservation and community in Scotland. With me, Nicolette McLeod.
And me, Graham Richardson. And thank you so much for tuning in to episode 5 of the podcast and the last episode in the first series.
Or episode 5 of 6, because I think we're going to do a sneaky little Christmas special.
Hopefully do a Christmas special, but is that, we've been arguing about this, is that episode 6? Is that a bonus episode? I don't know podcast etiquette, so I don't know the answer.
I think it's 6, because 6 is the best number, so we should do an episode 6.
Okay.
No. My favourite number. That's how I like to make choices in life.
Awesome. Then we have to do 42 episodes, because that's a lot of other people's favourite number.
Oh, really? But that's good, because 4 and 2 make 6, so I can work with that.
We didn't even plan that. So we do want to keep on going, and I hope after this conversation you want us to keep on going as well. And we do have some ideas. We want to interview more people. We want to get a real snapshot of what conservation and community is like in Scotland right now.
And we do also want to talk to artists whose work is maybe about the sea or they live by the coast and whose work kind of revolves around conservation as well. And just to get a different overview of people's experiences and people in Scotland and our coasts.
Basically, if you think you have some story to tell, or you're part of an organisation that has a story to tell, or you know someone, just get in touch. We would genuinely love to hear from you. We'll mention this again, but you can get us on Twitter at SeagazingPod, or on our emails. That's Nicolette@seagazing.com. Is that our email?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's Nicolette@seagazing.com or Graham@seagazing.com.
Yeah, we've got a great list of people. We've been geeking out over a spreadsheet, but always happy to hear from more bots.
You're starting to like spreadsheets, aren't
yes,
you?
Yes, I am.
But we still have one episode that we are going to do today. And what's it about,
it's
Nico?
It's all about birds! So...
Yay!
seabirds. And
not just seabirds, actually.
It's true. That's true. Oh, some other favourites are mentioned. And obviously Graham is doing this interview today because Graham is a bird geek.
Is that the correct terminology? Am I a bird geek?
You call yourself a bird geek, so that's what I'm calling you. And like, I've noticed how you kind of like to slip it into the beginning of most episodes, whether it's relevant
that's
or
true.
Not. So,
that's true. Well, I'm talking to someone who is less of a bird geek, more of a bird expert today. His name is David Parnaby, and he is the warden at the Fair Isle Bird Observatory. Fair Isle being the most remote inhabited island in the UK.
And
it's an absolute magnet for birds of all types, migratory birds and seabirds. So we're going to talk a lot about our feathered friends. We're also going to talk a lot about the community that's grown up with the Bird Observatory in the last 70 years. And because we touched on it quite early on, it's worth mentioning there was a fire there in 2019 that burned down the Fair Isle Observatory building. So we also talk about what they're doing to move on and their fundraising efforts. I mean, you talk about quite a lot of birds, so I will post some images on Twitter when the episode goes out. Just give you a nice picture of the birds, because birds are great.
Birds are great. So I wanted to have a moment at the beginning of this episode to ask Graham, when he thinks of a seabird, what image or picture it is that comes to mind, and he's just laughing at me.
I see what you did there. I think probably it's an image of a puffin. And also I should point out that if you can hear that in the background, I'm experiencing thunder snow, because apparently that's a meteorological thing in Scotland, and it's happening on my roof right now, just in case you hear any background noise. Imagine we're in a wild cliff in the north of Shetland, by the sea, looking at puffins, because puffins are they're gorgeous little birds, I think. It's surprising when you see them first just how small they are, and they've got these beautiful multicoloured bills during the breeding season, and they also burrow into the cliffs, so they're, you know, you're just walking and they're sort of circling around you, and they're trying to come to land near you, and if you're near their burrow, they land a bit away and get look very disgruntled at why are you standing too close? And then they'll just waddle up to you and disappear down a hole you didn't see. And it's just an amazing experience. He's very funny but surprisingly agile and sleek, handsome birds. They're great.
I've not yet to see a puffin, so...
You've not seen a puffin?
No.
Nicolette. Okay, so we're going to... Next breeding season, we're going to take Nicolette to the Isle of May and we'll do a live Isle of May podcast all about, I don't know, all the seabirds.
Yay!
It's very exciting.
I would love that. Awesome. There we go. We'll put that in the diary.
Great. Well, before that, shall we listen to the episode?
Yeah.
We like to start the podcast with a bit of an image of the sea. So when you close your eyes and when someone brings up the sea in conversation, what sort of image is it that comes into your mind?
Of the sea, I think Fair Isle is so connected with it. There can be so many things depending on on the time of year and what's going on. I think one of the things is always that my absolute favourite colour is that sort of bluey green that you get inside a rolling wave. And so quite often in the winter when it's a nice stormy day, we'll go and sit in the car at South Light with the kids and just watch the waves crashing and see which ones go for the biggest splashes. And every time that flash of bluey green appears, that always gets pointed out. And so, yeah, that would probably be my first thing. Some days it might be a nice flat calm sea where we can go out in our boat and count birds as well.
Yeah, for sure. So you said that you're on Fair Isle, and we're going to talk about Fair Isle today, but for people who've never heard of it, could you tell us where it is and how you ended up there?
Yeah, so to start with, it's a real place, which surprises some people. The Fair Isle knitting is so well known that I think a lot of people assume it's just a name for a knitwear pattern rather than an actual island. But a legendary
place.
And we're not the Faroes as well, which is something that a lot of people assume I've gone to live on the Faroes, but no, Fair Isle is part of Shetland, so the most northerly part of Britain is Shetland, and we're off the south tip of Shetland. Fair Isle is a small island, so it's only about 3 miles long, about a mile and a half wide at its widest point, but we're Britain's remotest inhabited island, so we're 20-odd miles south of Shetland and just a wee bit further north of Orkney.
Oh, what is it like to live on an island that remote? Do you wake up in the morning thinking I'm very far away from where I came from?
Initially I'm from Sunderland, so it's quite a contrast between growing up in the middle of it's now a city. It was a large town when I grew up there, and Fair Isle with a population of about 50 people. It's very different, but no, I don't think it does feel remote, really. The community is, as you can imagine, in a small place where people have to work together for things to work. The community is so well linked that I don't think you necessarily have that feeling of remoteness that you can do anywhere, really, can't you? But I don't think you get that here.
It's very true. I mean, people talk about feeling lonely in big cities, and it certainly can do. Speaking from Edinburgh, sometimes it does feel lonely. But that's something that's interesting, because I've known a few people that have gone to Fair Isle. I've never been, and I would love to go. But one of my friends who visited told me that Fair Isle has mad hospitality. She told me about someone who invited her to a party on the first day that she arrived, and someone who said, just come in and use the toilet in my house. If I'm not in there, you know, the door is unlocked, it's fine. So what is it about the community that makes it so welcoming and appealing to visitors?
It's always been known as a friendly and welcoming island, and it is a lovely setup here, and so I think people have a certain element of not necessarily wanting to show off about the island, but certainly wanting to show the island off to people. And I suppose our visit numbers are slightly limited. The amount of accommodation on the island is limited. There's only so much transport can get on and off the isle, and not always as much as you think is going to, because we're dependent on the weather, which can stop the boats and the planes from reaching us. So, you know, that maybe helps. We're not like some places in in the UK, where perhaps once the tourism kicks off, you can get that slightly uneasy balance where you get maybe a few too many tourists and it makes life a bit more awkward for the people who live there. Tourism's always been important, or increasingly important, to the Isle economy, but I think just having people visit the island has always been important as well. It's a small community, and having new people coming in and joining the community and maybe bringing new ideas, or maybe just bringing an extra pair of hands to be able to do some of the jobs that they're doing, has always been appreciated. So Suzanne and my wife and I, we run the Bird Observatory and have done now for getting on for 10 years. So we came up for an interview with three or four couples who were being interviewed for the same post. We all came on at the same time, stayed at the Bird Observatory with the directors of the Bird Observatory, who were the interview panels. So it was an unusual set of circumstances for a job interview. And part of the few days that we were here, there was a social event was put on at the observatory so the islanders could come up and give all of the candidates a chance to ask people questions and just meet the islanders and sort of get a bit of a feel for the place, which was really nice. At the time, we had first daughter was just about a year old, and we were chatting to someone at the bar, and he was asking what we were going to do with Grace during the actual interview itself, because Suzanne and I had both been together, and we thought, oh, actually we hadn't really planned on babysitting, and he said, well, just drop her off at ours if you want, we can look after her. And I thought, there can't be many places where virtually the first time you meet someone is in a bar and they offer to babysit your kids, and there certainly can't be many places where you would think that was a perfectly sensible idea. So,
yeah, that's true.
So it's just that sort of thing, as you say, from your friend's experience as well.
And you're still there, so it worked out okay. They did a good job.
And I think we didn't really have a plan when we moved here as to how long we would stay on Fair Isle. The Bird Observatory is a wonderful opportunity for anyone interested in wildlife to work at the Bird Observatory. But I think maybe, 10 years later, we would have perhaps been a bit surprised to find we were still here. But you've got the birds, you've got the other wildlife, you've got the scenery, all that is fantastic. But you've then got the community, and so many of our friends are the people who live on the Isle now, but that's one of the things that's helped to keep us here.
So the Bird Observatory was opened in 1948, so it's been around for quite a long time, and it must feel pretty integrated into the community in general. So how has the community and the observatory evolved together in that time?
Yeah, so it's a really sort of fascinating history, and there's been some good books written that go into it in a lot more detail. But George Waterston, who founded the Bird Observatory, did so partially for the study of bird migration and the monitoring of the breeding birds, but also to help Fair Isle, who's a regular visitor. You can imagine back in the 1940s, an island this remote was often left behind in terms of advances in technology and living standards. And so it was a very tough life for people. And so he wanted to help the island by providing a facility people could come and stay, spend money on the island. So from the very start, the Isle and the observatory have kind of been meshed in together like that. In fact, George Waterston bought the island when he set up the Bird Observatory. He then ended up giving it to the National Trust for Scotland because he thought they would be in a better position to actually look after the island. So the observatory is now separate from the NTS, who look after the isle, but is still very much part of the community. And that, they've just sort of grown up alongside each other. The observatory bar is where you have social events, and so the whole isle can come together for events there, quite often music nights from isle musicians, often joined by people who've just come off yachts with their instruments as well. So it's always a good night when that sort of thing happens as well. We've tried as well where possible, and it's not always easy, but we try to employ island residents where we can. Now, most people on the island have a whole variety of jobs, and so seasonal work, full-time seasonal work doesn't often suit because they've got so many other things to do as well. Over the years, some of our best childcarers have been some of the islanders, and the kids are still great friends with them, so that's lovely to see. And we've got a brilliant primary school here, currently got a school roll of three, of which two of them are our kids.
First thing it seems.
Another link between the island and the community there is the fact that we're responsible for most of the primary school. It is a nice relationship between the island and the observatory.
And so the island now welcomes a lot of tourists and researchers, I guess, as well, to the bird observatory. Does that change the dynamic of the island in any way, or is it the part of the island now?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, tourism in Shetland has increased an awful lot in the last 10, 15 years or so, I guess. And so whilst the Bird Observatory initially, I think, would have been particularly busy in the autumn when it was the keen bird watchers, the whole isle now has a lot of interest in people visiting from sort of spring through to autumn. So you almost have the year sort of split into the tourist season, if you like, and then the winter season. And so the winter is... most of the visitors tend to be friends or family of the islanders coming up. And so they're both very different feels. But I think the feeling of having people on the isle in the summer is just part and parcel of what people expect in Fair Isle in the summer. And over the last couple of years, with first of all the observatory burning down, but then this year, obviously, with the COVID situation as well, a lot of people on the isle have commented just how strange it is not having as many folk visiting as we would normally. And so many people visit Fair Isle and fall in love with Fair Isle that some of them stay on the isle as well. And so I think it's something like about a third of the households on the isle have got at least one person in who's either come and fallen in love with the isle and decided to stay here, or fallen in love with someone on the isle and decided to stay here. We had a project a couple of years ago in which the isle got new wind turbines and solar panels to cut down on the reliance on diesel generators, just try and make the electricity supply both affordable and cleaner as well. And two of the workmen who came on settled onto the isle with women on the isle who they met. So that's quite nice as well. So it's a bit of pressure on whoever comes to build the bird observatory that they might have a similar number of New Isle residents. But
it's an intense dating service. The island doesn't rely so much on the sea as an economic source anymore, does it? Is that right?
Yeah. I suppose one of the problems with Fair Isle has always been that just getting anything off the isle you've got to get it to Shetland first and then down to Scotland if you're wanting to sell stuff more widely or whatever. And because of the limits of the weather, there's no guarantee that if you were to go fishing, for example, or catching lobsters or crabs, that there's no guarantee when you would get them away. And you've got the added transport cost. So it's probably never been quite as big a part of the isle economy as people would imagine a small island in the middle of the North Sea and Atlantic would be. It certainly was more important. It has declined, I think, because with the sort of economies of scale and the likes as well, then it becomes pretty much unviable to run any sort of fishing-related business or anything like that. But I think the isle was granted a marine protected area status not that long ago, and that had the support of the entire community. And that was because they recognised that the health of the sea basically had a big impact on Fair Isle, because you don't have the breeding seabirds, then that's one of the big draws for a lot of visitors. So it's all kind of linked in, and people were, it was one of the big plus points of the MPA campaign, was that you had entire community support, which I think is pretty unusual.
I think that might be unique. And you have the only research and development MPA as well, which I assume brings a lot more researchers to the island and sort of encourages more engagement with the sea.
Yeah, so it's sort of been stalled a wee bit by the observatory fire, because the plan was that the OBS would be a good base for people working out of, and so things have stalled a little bit, but there will be a a job has now been created to go with the MPA and a lass in Shetland who family are actually from Fair Isle who's been appointed to the role. So, yeah, very much the plan that will bring more research, and the observatory, once it's up and running again, will be a good place to be a base for that.
So I first heard of Fair Isle because of the birds. My friend told me she was going to visit a bird paradise, and I got very jealous. And I think along with the knitting, those are the two main reasons that people have heard of Fair Isle. So I saw a video that Chris Packham sent to you the other day to help with your fundraising. And in it, he described Fair Isle as having some of the sexiest birds that you can see in the UK. So what is it that makes Fair Isle so great for birds?
I'm glad that's where that question went. So I have to talk about what makes a bird sexy. We could have an entirely different path, yeah, couldn't we? But in terms of what makes Fair Isle good for birds, so we've got sort of two different, if you like, groups of birds that are of interest. So the breeding seabirds, which are very important. We've got big populations, thousands of gannets, guillemots, razorbills, puffins, lots of other species as well. So the fact that we're an offshore island, we have no natural land predators on the island. So we've been very lucky. Rats have never made it here. We don't have anything like foxes, stoats, none of those sort of things. So it means that birds can nest safely, and obviously being in the middle of the sea, they've got access to food, although that's something we can maybe chat about a wee bit later about the state of seabirds and their food. So that's one group of birds. The other are the migrant birds, and that's the ones that attract the bird watchers, because Fair Isle has got one of the best reputations for rare birds anywhere in Britain. Indeed, it's one of the most famous sites in Europe for attracting vagrants from all points of the compass, basically. And it does that because, as I mentioned, it's a remote island. So if you are a small bird weighing, you know, 15 to 20 grams, crossing the North Sea, maybe even crossing the Atlantic, you can't afford to go wrong, any bad weather, anything like that, and you can be in real trouble. So if you're crossing the North Sea and you're looking for somewhere to stop, then Fair Isle's got nice big cliffs, it's nice and visible for miles around, so it just acts as a beacon for migrating birds, and they'll get drawn in so they can rest up before continuing their migration. When they get here, it's such a small island that we can actually see most of it. You know, we can get around it in the day. So we've got myself and two assistant wardens, and part of our daily work with the observatory is doing the census. So we divide the island into three sections. One of us goes around each section. We basically count virtually all of the birds that we encounter on that. So there's a very good chance that anything that turns up here gets found, and also just the habitat here. So we don't really have trees.
Which is unusual for birds.
So the birds have to make do with what they can find. So it might be a small patch of rose bush in a garden. It might be a nettle patch or a thistle patch. And that just makes them that much more visible. So there's species like lanceolated warbler, which is a small warbler, breeds in Siberia. Very, very rare to see in Britain. Almost all of the ones we see are creeping around in ditches, often just running around at people's feet, because that's what they do. They're almost like mice when they get here. You don't see them in flight. They don't perch out in the open. So if they land on the coast, anywhere on the mainland, they'll disappear into a woodland and never get seen again, whereas here there's a good chance of picking them up. Yeah, all those sort of things combine and draw the bird watchers in, and then the more bird watchers you get, the more chance you've got of things getting found as well.
For sure, and it's a pretty insane list. I think it was 391 species you've recorded.
Yeah, so it depends on exactly how you count them. The world of birds taxonomy means that things change all the time, but yeah, it's getting up towards 400 species.
And to put that into context, again, it probably depends a little bit on where you find the stat, but about 600 bird species have been recorded in the UK, so it's a pretty huge percentage.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's about 30 or so species have actually been added to the British list from Fair Isle. So it gives you an idea of sort of the chances of finding something particularly rare are particularly good on here for such a small island. It has a disproportionately large impact on British ornithology.
And I saw that you have actually found, you've added a species to the list yourself, is that correct? The glaucous winged gull? I'm not sure if I'm saying that right.
That was a new one for Fair Isle and a new one for Scotland as well. So a species from the northwest coast of America, so really shouldn't be here at all. And that was so most of our birds we find will be out when we're doing the census, which we do from end of March through to end of October. That one was actually, I think I just dropped the kids off at school, just dropped Grace off at school and saw it from the car on the drive back. So.
just like that.
Yeah.
No, it sounds amazing. So, but this isn't just, it's not just a checklist exercise. It's not just seeing a rare bird and you know, ticking it off. You are actually collecting data. So what is it you do with the migratory birds?
Yeah, so initially when the observatory was set up, part of the idea was just to see what could turn up, because there weren't the number of bird watchers that there are now, there weren't the same number of studies going on. So the idea was to try and discover a bit more about what rare species could turn up. Now we have a much better idea on that now. It's still a lovely bonus when it happens when we're out on census, but as you say, that's not the main part of it. So what we're doing is recording the numbers of pretty much all of the species we see. The only ones we wouldn't count on a daily basis are some of the resident breeding land birds, house sparrows, starlings, and some of the breeding seabirds, because we don't want to be counting 40,000 pairs of fulmars every day during the spring. So all of those get monitored and censused in other ways, but for the daily census it's counting all of the other birds that are coming through. And we then have a log at the end of every day, so we record all the numbers when we've got the observatory and we've got people here. We do that as a public event so everybody can hear what's been around, can contribute their sightings if there's anything that they've seen that we haven't. We did actually do a public log by Zoom the other night, just because we're missing having the birders on here so much, we just opened it up. So all of that data then goes into the log. We still do the log by paper at the moment, but it then all gets computerized. That can then get entered into some of the national recording schemes, but also we've then got it just instantly available for anyone who might be doing research on a particular species, looking at changes in abundance, or the observatory trust has also employed people to analyse the data looking at groups of species, and so we can look at things like timings of migration as well. So it's a vast wealth of data, and having something that's been collected in a systematic manner for so long is pretty rare, so it makes it a really valuable data set.
And do the community in the island and the people that come and visit, do they play an important role in collecting that data as well?
Yeah, so everyone is more than welcome to contribute their sightings, and certainly when it comes to some of the more unusual species, we have obviously a little phone network of sightings, so we get all of that. It was particularly important this year. We've got some really good observers on the isle, and in the spring we didn't get our seasonal staff on, but it meant that for people's daily exercise walks, they would go out and record what they saw in certain areas. So it wasn't quite the same as the full census, but because we've got people on the isle who were more than happy to help and know their birds very well, we were still able to get some data recorded during the spring, which was great.
Yeah, it's really important to have that community at this time.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
So we've got the migratory birds, but as you say, we've also got the seabirds, and you've got a pretty large data set on seabirds and breeding success. So what? How does the work differ between the migratory birds and the seabirds? What are you doing differently?
Yeah, so from usually from about May time, the seabird breeding season becomes more active, so they start breeding quite late in the year compared to other things. And so we have a period where we're kind of overlapping and it gets very hectic, and then during the summer it's very intense looking at the seabirds, because they pack all of their breeding season into as short a time as possible, because seabirds by and large are so well adapted for life out at sea that the only thing that they have to come to shore for is because they can't, you know, they can't float an egg on the surface of the sea and incubate it. So the only thing they have to come to shore for is to have their eggs. They're more vulnerable there, so they want to get it over and done with as quick as possible generally. So it's a really, really hectic time. So for just about every species, we'll look at the numbers that are breeding on the isle and the productivity, so how many chicks each pair produce. So again, it's that systematic collection of data that's important. So back in the 1980s, photographs were taken of various plots around the island, so sections of cliff, and they were marked up and left in a folder. And since then, every year, we go back to the same place at the same time of year. We count how many birds are nesting in that area, and we look at how many chicks are produced from each pair that are nesting in that area as well. For most species as well, we will try and get a whole island count, but because of the work involved, some of those are done on a five-year rotation. So yeah, it's a really intense piece of work, but it's great fun as well. I mean, seabirds have just got such character, and you can see why a lot of people love them, even if they're not bird watchers as such.
Yeah, I think if you've never been to somewhere like Fair Isle or the Isle of May, or I don't know if you can get to Skomer in Wales, but just a seabird breeding colony, I've seen people who have no interest in birds just being absolutely fascinated, first by puffins, but they get drawn in by other things as well. And so have you noticed any particular trends among the different species? And I know that in certain parts of the UK, there's worries about overfishing, fish stocks being depleted, and that affecting various populations of seabirds. Is that the case from the Fair Isle data?
Yeah, so obviously lots of different species and lots of different sort of niches that they occupy, and therefore different results for them. But what we've tended to see is that the birds that are relying on the small oily fish that are really rich in energy, so sand eels are the classic one, they have by and large suffered in the last sort of 20 or 30 years. There was a big sand eel fishery in Shetland, and initially some big problems of lack of breeding on Shetland were linked to that. But increasingly what we know is that climate change is the underlying cause to a lot of the problems. The sea just has to get a tiny bit warmer and it has an effect on the plankton and it has an effect on the fish. And unfortunately, whilst the plankton and sand eels may still be there and shift their distribution, numbers of or areas that the seabirds can breed are more limited. And so, yeah, the birds are kind of tied to their nesting sites. And so if the seabirds' food is then found somewhere else, it can make it quite tricky. So we've seen some big declines. Things like kittiwakes really suffered. And that's one of the ones that anyone who's been on the island for a few decades will tell you that, you know, they would come in on the little islander plane and you would see the cloud of kittiwakes come up off the cliffs like a snowstorm, describe it. And so we've gone from somewhere in the region of about 20,000 breeding pairs of kittiwakes down to just a few hundred now. They're just not finding the food they need. And some of the other seabirds have declined as well. Guillemots, razorbills, sure, similar declines. Arctic skuas that will steal food off those species have obviously suffered as a result as well. So that's quite sad to see. And increasingly technology plays a big part in seabird monitoring. And so in recent years we've had the RSPB and the BTO have both come and put trackers on various species of seabirds to see what they're doing. And it's showing things like guillemots will go out and instead of being able to find the fish that they need within a few miles of Fair Isle, the studies were finding is that they were quite often having to go down as far as the Aberdeenshire coast, sometimes even a bit further on their fishing trips, which is just totally unsustainable in terms of then finding enough fish to keep your chicks going, unfortunately. So that's pretty tough. Some species are doing much better. Gannets, large seabirds, eat larger fish, take things like mackerel, have a big foraging range as well. Gannets can go hundreds of miles on a feeding trip, and they have just colonised in the last sort of 40, 50 years. And we've got about 4,000 pairs of those now, so they're doing quite well. The bonksies, which get quite a lot of their food by stealing it from the gannets, they're doing quite well on the isle as well. It's mixed in terms of how things are doing. This year, though, was quite a pleasing one. The seasonal staff came to the island in early June and it was absolutely full pelt going for the seabird monitoring work. They didn't wait for us, obviously, they just got on. But things like Arctic skuas, for example, the seabird monitoring this year was almost exactly the same as it would be every other year. And it looks like it's been their best breeding season for over 20 years in terms of the number of chicks they've produced. So it's really interesting that for some species, the last couple of years just seem to have shown a slight sort of uptick in terms of how they're getting on.
That's good and very important, therefore, that you keep collecting data. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about bird ringing as well, because it's the process of catching a bird, putting a tag on it, and letting it go again. And I'm not sure if people that have but don't have a particular interest in birds know what happens next. What do you get data-wise from ringing birds?
Yeah. So it's very easy for once you've lived at a bird observatory for 10 years to forget that these sort of things are not necessarily normal for most people. Start their day by opening a net in their garden and catching blackbirds and robins or whatever. But it's a very simple process. You can use a mist net to catch the birds, or we have Helgoland traps, just a big wooden frame funnel covered in wire that you drive the birds down to a catching box at the far end. Get the birds out. It takes a few seconds, you know, no more than a minute to process a bird, which involves putting a small metal ring on the leg with a unique number on it. Very lightweight, so just the equivalent of putting a wristwatch on a human. But that ring has a number on it that if the bird is caught anywhere else or found dead, we can find out where it's gone to. Particularly by doing it over many years, you can see a lot of interesting stuff about where the birds go to and from. So just in the last couple of weeks, for example, we had a robin that we ringed here, turned up on big easterly winds. And this one clearly, rather than coming through Fair Isle to get into Britain for the winter, this one had clearly been blown off course and was determined that it should be wintering somewhere on the European mainland, because a couple of days after we'd ringed it, it was back in Norway. So been blown across the sea with slightly better conditions and just went back across. And species like the robin and the blackbird that, you know, down in Edinburgh, you might have a robin in your garden all year round. It might be the same robin, it might not. You might be getting, you know, birds from Norway or Russia coming to your garden in the winter. And once you start putting rings on them, you can start to see these sort of things as well. And it's not just us doing it. There's a network of bird observatories through Britain, and a lot of volunteers do it at their own sites as well. So every year there are hundreds of thousands of birds get ringed. And once you build that up and build that up over the years, you get a really good picture of where the birds are going. Yeah, it's a really, really fascinating sort of aspect of the work we do.
Birds are great. People don't always believe me when I say it, but birds are great. It's just awesome.
I think there's a bird out there for everyone. I think, you know, if you want, any small child will be fascinated by birds. I don't know whether it's just a movement or what it is, but small enough child will always like seeing birds. If there's somebody there who can interest them and just encourage that, that'll stick with them. They don't have to be bird watchers to appreciate them. I just think there's something everywhere. Just so many people will tell me that they've got, you know, they're not bird watchers, but they do like seeing the goldfinches in their garden. Or they're not bird watchers, but there's a blue tit in the nest box. They're not bird watchers, but they feed the swans down at the park. There just seems to be a bird for everyone out there somewhere, I think. Maybe not everyone's found their bird yet, but...
But is it go looking? Go looking in Fair Isle when we can. So obviously we've talked a little bit about the pandemic already, and that's affected, I mean, everyone, I think, pretty much worldwide. But you've had a doubly difficult year in that in March 2019, you had a fire that burned down the physical observatory. Could you talk a little bit about what happened that day?
Yeah. So the Bell Observatory is closed to guests. It opens there usually in early April until the end of October. So we were fortunate that it was closed at the time, although obviously it was fully booked for visitors during the season. Susanna and the kids and I had not long been back from holiday. We'd taken our winter holidays and we're just back on the Isle. It had snowed. It was a horrible day the day before, but I remember it was a really, really grim driving hail and snow and stuff. But it was enough to get the sledge out, so that was something. We don't get sledgeable weather every year, so that was all right. And yeah, it was a Sunday morning, 10th of March. We were all out at chapel in the morning as a family, and just after the service, somebody came to to get us to tell us that the Orbs was on fire. The Good Shepherd had sailed that morning and they just left the harbour, which is near the observatory. And one of the crew saw smoke, so they came back. And, called out the fire service, which is obviously a part-time fire service on the Isle. As you can imagine, it's a reasonable size building. There's one fire engine on Fair Isle, there's one fire crew. And so it was always going to be a struggle to contain it. And unfortunately, it was a really good effort by the fire crew. They were joined by teams from Shetland, got flown in and came in by boat as well. And it was a massive effort to try and save the building, and unfortunately just not quite successful. Susanna and the kids and I have a sort of flat attached to the building as well. So that was everything was lost. The bird observatory, our flat, even the garage and the fire sort of jumped across to that. It was just so intense. We were, when we first got to the scene, we were sort of able to dash in, grab the computers we got. Got the work laptops out, got a few bits and pieces, family photos and just a few bits you could grab. But that was it, really. Most of the stuff got lost, and pretty much everything from the OBS itself. Thankfully, just a few years beforehand, we'd completed a digitisation of the log data. So all of that data back from 1948 and the handwritten logs had all been put onto spreadsheets and was all saved. So that was huge. If we'd lost that, it would have been a big thing. Obviously, the building was lost. That's where the seasonal staff stay. All the guests would stay, and so we were in communication with the directors very quickly afterwards. Everyone was very keen to have a commitment to rebuild the observatory. I'm very keen to carry on with the work, so it was only sort of 2 or 3 weeks till the staff were due to come in and start, and not that long afterwards that the observatory was due to open to guests. So it was a bit of a scramble to work things out, but the community were just every bit as wonderful as anyone who knows Fair Isle would imagine they would be. The Shetland Island Council was very quick to help Susanna and the kids and I. So we got rehoused on the island. The National Trust for Scotland had a property empty that we were able to rent out, at least for the seasonal staff. We had to sort of reorganise things with the seasonal staff quite hurriedly, and we were also very lucky in that we had a whole team of people who'd either visited or volunteered previously who wanted to help out, so we were able to kind of slot people together to form a sort of jigsaw of a whole team over the course of the season. So we managed to get all of the work done, actually, which was I think very important, not just for keeping that continuity of the data, but I think psychologically for us was a big thing as well. It sort of gave us something to focus on and work towards as well.
I can't imagine how devastating that must have been. I mean, if that happened here to an organisation or to a community, it would be big, but for an island of 60 people, that must have been pretty life-changing. But it's kind of remarkable to hear about the resilience of the community, and it feels like without them we may not be talking today about the next stage of rebuilding and the bird observatory.
And I think it was a big part of the commitment to the rebuild. It was not just for the data, it was for what it means to the Isle as well. I think the two sort of go together, and absolutely no doubt that it's had a big impact. Obviously, there are some other accommodation providers on the island. Some people have bed and breakfasts, but the vast majority are visitors who come and stay at the bird observatory. And so for the people of whom tourism is a big part of their income, that was a big blow. And not just for individuals selling knitwear and the likes. The bird observatory orders all of its food through the local shop. The bird observatory is the only bar on the island, so we had the only public bar, and all of the alcohol was ordered through the local shop as well. And so a lot of money goes through the local shop, which helps to keep the local shop going. It's one of those things that it's very easy to have that knock-on effect of once you You know, if you lose a local shop, it can have an impact on the whole isle. And once you start losing things like that, it can quickly snowball if you're not careful. So, yeah, I think everyone on the isle is very keen to get the Bird Observatory up and running again. And as you say, I think that has made a big difference in the efforts to get the rebuild going.
Well, on that note, to be positive, you are having a rebuild. It's been approved to be rebuilt in 2021. So what are the next steps? What are the future for the observatory through to next year? And I guess what's the future of the community in that sense?
Yeah, so the plans are submitted and approved. There should be the tenders should be getting signed off fairly soon. So it's all progressing. I suppose one of the not really a positive of the coronavirus, but in the sense that if the two things were going to coincide, I suppose it's kind of helped in that so far it's not really had any impact on the rebuild. So the rebuild at this point has been mostly office based stuff and things that people can catch up over Zoom and phone calls and the like. So so thankfully that's not impacted on things yet. And we're hoping that the rebuild will be next year with a view to hopefully opening in 2022. And I think that's quite important to have a sort of idea of when this will happen. It's been a long process, been a hard process. The directors of the Bird Observatory Trust are all volunteers. I mean, most of them are volunteers who volunteer to help run the Bird Observatory because either they're fans of Fair Isle or maybe they've got an interest in the data collection, or quite often, they've just come and stayed and they've got skills that we can use and they want to help out because they've come to love the place. I don't think any of them were planning to have to get involved in the sort of stuff that they had to get involved in for this. It's been a huge amount of work for them. Where we're at the minute is the sort of fundraising stage, just to plug the final gaps of the fundraising. So the building was insured, and that covers the vast majority of the costs, but Fair Isle is not an easy place to build something like that. It's a difficult place to get to. It has a lot of issues with transport, getting larger things on. Last time the Bird Observatory was rebuilt, you had to do things like widen some of the roads just so that the machinery that was used to rebuild it could get to the site. So there's lots to take into account, and there's a few things that we want to improve on the previous previous building. The directors have agreed amongst themselves that they would like to go sort of above and beyond the standards to try and do what they can to improve fire safety. So there's also a plan that the research facilities will be much better on this one. We've talked about the MPA and so, you know, having a much better lab for researchers to visit will be an important part of that as well. So yeah, that sort of leaves us wanting a wee bit extra money. We've been very lucky so far. Obviously, it's very tough times for a lot of folk, but there's an appeal ongoing at the minute, and we've had a wonderful response. Mostly just lots and lots of small donations from a wide variety of people, which I think says a lot about Fair Isle and the Orbs and the love that people have for it. And I think that's been really, really touching for us all.
So where can people go to donate if they like to do that?
Thanks for that. Yeah, we've got a website, so if you just search for Fair Isle Bird Observatory, you'll find all the links on there for how people can donate. We've got a Facebook and Twitter as well, obviously. And for people who maybe already have donated or who can't afford to donate, and we appreciate that not everyone will be able to, they can help just by sharing that stuff as well. Even now, only a year and a half after the fire, we're still getting people who had maybe stayed on Fair Isle years ago and have only just found out about the fire and are quite willing to help and quite keen to help and to donate. And it just shows actually that, yeah, just spreading the word about a bit can make a big difference as well. So yeah, if people are able to share tweets, share Facebook posts and just boost the profile a bit, then that's really helpful.
Great. Well, we're coming to an end, but I just wanted to ask, for people who are at home right now but are thinking of visiting Fair Isle, you know, when that becomes possible again, how can people engage with what's going on now, and how will they be able to engage in the next year or two?
Yeah, so hopefully we'll start seeing a few more visitors next year. That would be really helpful. I mean, certainly in the meantime, you know, keep having a look at our website. The Fair Isle community has a website as well. And Christmas coming up, people might want to think about maybe supporting some of the Fair Isle knitters. You know, maybe get online, buy a pair of gloves or a jumper for someone. You know, they've really suffered, not just with the lack of tourists from the Alps, but cruise ships are actually quite a big part. We don't get a lot of cruise ships, but maybe a dozen or so during the course of the year, and we've not had any of them. So a big impact on a lot of people. We're looking at ways as well of trying to involve people a bit more in terms of some of the data. We're sort of trying to come up with a few ideas at the minute, just because we know it's going to be another year before we've got the bird observatory up and running. So, like, for example, at the minute we're doing nocturnal migration recordings, which is quite a new thing, and we're looking to see whether maybe we can put things online for people to listen in and identify those, and just try and find ways of getting folk involved in some of the research and data, and just staying connected with us, because we know a lot of people miss their chance to visit Fair Isle, and we miss having them here. So anything like that we can do that can get them involved is going to be good.
We do love citizen science projects and the podcast, so that sounds perfect. And it's a perfect way to end. I really hope I get to visit Fair Isle soon. I'll be so excited I won't be able to sleep. I'll just be up at night watching all the petrels come in. David, thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much. It's been lovely to speak to you. And yes, we will hopefully see you soon.
So thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that episode. And I did just want to add, David mentioned at the start that the Faroes and Fair Isle get confused a lot, which is understandable. But when I was talking to my flatmate this morning about what we were going to be recording today, he got very excited and told me that Fair Isle had the world's first underwater roundabout, which of course wasn't true. It's the Faroe Islands. So that's proving his point.
An underwater roundabout.
I thought you might have questions. Yes, apparently the Faroe Islands have tunnels connecting some of the different islands.
What?
And there's now a roundabout, which is opening, was supposed to open in 2021, but just for a treat, is now opening before Christmas.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. I haven't actually verified this story, so this is me completely going in my flatmate.
Could be fake news.
Could be fake news. I hope not, because that is a great story.
It is a great story. If you want to hear more about Fair Isle Bird Observatory, head over to their website at fairislebirdobs.co.uk and do share their story so other people can hear about them. And if you're able, do give them some money so they can help rebuild their centre and so more people can go there and they can carry on the fabulous work that they're doing.
It's also a great time to get your first ever piece of Fair Isle clothing, a pair of gloves or a jumper. I hear they're very cosy. But if you do get them, make sure that you're getting them from Fair Isle itself. But, Nico, just before we finish, because you surprised me with the question earlier, I thought I would ask, if there's a bird for everyone, what's your bird, do you think?
What is my bird? Oh, that's tricky. I like so many birds. I think it would have to be a wren. And I think partly because they're really small and they're also incredibly loud and I like hearing them because they're quite an easily recognisable bird. Yeah, I would say if you're into finding out how to learn to recognise birds, they're a really good place to start. So I'd suggest starting with them. And the other thing is, because I live in a city, yeah, I often see them in unexpected places and I derive a lot of comfort from seeing them and hearing them because they're really cute and they have tiny little tails.
Tiny little tails that point up straight to the sky.
And you see them in like people's front gardens and in the undergrowth. So often maybe I might be like walking along feeling a bit sad or serious and then I'll look and there's a little wren. It's so nice.
And to make this podcast circular, one of the best views I've ever had of a wren was on South Arran, just after we'd passed Lamlash Bay. It was just hopping around for rocks at the coast, and you normally see them in bushes, stuck there. Well, not stuck there.
Hopefully not stuck in
just
a bush.
Living there.
Yeah, hanging out in a bush.
But if you also have a favourite bird, we would love to hear about it. You can get us on Twitter at SeaGazingPod, or you can also email us with all your suggestions about interesting people that we should talk to and also feedback about the episode so far.
And thank you so much to David for coming along today. It was really lovely to hear about the work that they're doing. And I really hope to go in the future to see their new centre.
Me too. And if you want to find out more about Fair Isle, as we said, you can go to their website or there are also links at seagazing.com.
And thank you so much for listening. And we'll see you next time.